flinch when our interests are threatened, yet we do not seek confrontation.
But the U.S. Defense Secretary has some strong words for China. It's Wednesday, July 28th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, another high-ranking U.S. official is in China with similar words, a major setback for the U.S. at the Olympics. A Hong Kong verdict has long-term implications for the city. Myanmar takes an even stronger stance against civilian rule. Smoke from the West Coast fires cover much of the United States. It is all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin addressed deterring Chinese aggression in Southeast Asia Tuesday, declaring the U.S. seeks a stable relationship with China while working to resolve common challenges. Secretary made his comments in Singapore while on an Asian trip. VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb is on that trip with Secretary Austin, and she joins us now. Carla, thanks for being with us. Relations between both countries, the United States and China, have deteriorated rather sharply over recent years. How did Secretary Austin suggest going toward a more stable relationship?
Well, Secretary Austin spoke of his vision for what he called integrated deterrence for the region. And that's a plan to beef up the U.S. military capabilities in the region while also improving the allies' ability to work together. Because he says that the one thing that the U.S. has over China is its biggest, well, not the one thing I should say, but the biggest thing, the biggest advantage that the U.S. has is its ability to have all of these great allies and partners. And he thinks that together, working together, that's what's really going to discourage Chinese bullying behavior. Let's listen to what he said about integrated deterrence.
Beijing's claim to the vast majority of the South China Sea has no basis in international law. That assertion treads on the sovereignty of the states in the region. We continue to support the region's coastal states in upholding their rights under international law.
Case in point, there are Chinese vessels out there right now that are harassing Philippine fishermen in their economic zone. There are also Chinese vessels that are encroaching on Vietnamese or Malaysian gas and oil companies, trying to prevent them for what the U.S. says is their right and what international law says is their right to develop their energy resources. These are happening. And so the U.S. is trying to say that, look, one person doesn't have the right to say how the rule of the law is in one certain area. It's international law that says how those rules go. And international law is kind of stepping up for these smaller nations like Vietnam, the Philippines, Taiwan also, for example. And so that is what the main point that Austin was trying to make. Allies and partners. Let's use this integrated deterrence together to try to beef up our capabilities and kind of push China in the right direction without directly confronting China.
Is this really aimed at going toward a more stable relationship? Because it seems to be that it's valid, but still complaints.
Well, you have a good point. And so I was speaking with Murray Hybert of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and he was pointing out that there's a lot of anxiety in this region about the high-level tensions between China and the U.S. over a ton of issues from Hong Kong, Taiwan, the South China Sea. It keeps going and going. And they are worried in this region that they're going to get caught in the middle, and they don't want to be forced to choose between the U.S. and China. And Austin addressed that directly in his speech today. He said that the U.S. and the Biden administration is not asking allies to choose between Washington and Beijing. But, he even noted kind of jokingly that many regional partnerships with the U.S. in this area are older than the Chinese Communist Party themselves. But he kind of held out what sounded like an olive branch to China, asking to work together in areas that they could agree on, like climate change. And let's listen to what he has to say when he was talking about China.
As Secretary, I am committed to pursuing a constructive, stable relationship with China, including stronger crisis communications with the People's Liberation Army. Big powers need to model transparency and communication. In And so we hope that we can work together with Beijing on common challenges, especially the threat of climate change.
Carla Babb is VOA's Pentagon correspondent. Carla, good luck on the rest of this trip, and thanks for being with us. Other U.S. officials were also overseas talking about relations with China. Stay with us for that. This is VOA Asia. These are some of the stories you'll find at voanews.com. Authorities in Bangkok plan to convert 15 disused railway carriages into a 240-bed COVID-19 isolation ward. India says it will meet an end-of-July domestic vaccine supply target. Australian sentenced for trying to sell North Korean missile parts. China's industrial profit growth slows in June on high raw material prices. Pakistan reopens Afghanistan border crossing held by Taliban. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and at the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. A senior U.S. diplomat on Tuesday called on China to rise above their differences and work with the United States on difficult global issues such as climate change and the COVID-19 pandemic as a responsible global power. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman was speaking in a phone interview with the Associated Press after talks Monday with Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi and Vice Foreign Minister Xi Feng. She said the U.S. welcomes vigorous economic competition with China, but does not want it to veer into conflict. China has bristled at American criticism on issues from human rights to its territorial ambitions and said repeatedly that the U.S. cannot expect cooperation while also suppressing China's development, a charge that Sherman denies. Sherman said she had frank conversations with Chinese officials on the issues that divide them.
It's the role of responsible nations and the essence of diplomacy to have open, honest discussions, particularly where we disagree. And yes, I had frank and direct conversations in many areas with my interlocutors, including the crimes against humanity in Xinjiang, the anti-democratic crackdown in Hong Kong, provocative military actions in the Taiwan Strait, and the concern shared by the United States and our allies and partners over economic coercion, cyber hacking, as well as Beijing's coercive and aggressive actions in the East and South China Seas.
Sherman's China visit was added late to an Asian itinerary that included stops in Japan, South Korea, and Mongolia amid wrangling over protocol between Beijing and Washington. You're listening to VOA Asia. Happening now in Asia, thousands of foreigners have left Indonesia in recent weeks, apparently spurred by a brutal pandemic wave and a general shortage of vaccines, which have gone to high priority groups first. Indonesia now has the most confirmed daily cases in Asia. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We are happy you are with us on VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Tuesday's slate of competitions at the Tokyo Olympics was filled with a number of stunning defeats and setbacks over a variety of events. Steve Ross is in Tokyo covering the Olympics for VOA.
Tokyo's 2020 Summer Olympics is at last underway and is exciting sports fans, both Japanese and international. But just 4 days following the opening ceremony, the host city faces more trouble due to spiking COVID-19 case numbers. Tokyo Metropolitan Government confirmed roughly 2,850 new COVID-19 cases on Tuesday, the highest daily count ever, and nearly 300 more than January's previous single-day record. Since the start of July, when athletes arrived to begin pre-games training, about 155 Olympics-related individuals have tested positive for COVID-19, including a small number of athletes. Another threat raising concern today is Tropical Storm Nepartek. Rain and wind associated with the storm front arriving in Tokyo on Tuesday morning, but it was not as devastating as feared. Rather, the stormy weather helped dissipate some of the unpleasant heat plaguing these games. While the early morning rain did delay the start of the women's triathlon, it may have given a cool lift to Flora Duffy as she competed to win Bermuda's first ever Olympic gold medal. Many tennis fans are likely to be disappointed that Olympic cauldron lighter Naomi Osaka is already out of the games, losing to Czechoslovakia's Markéta Vondrousova. It was Osaka's first tournament since dropping out of the French Open in May. Osaka was competing for the Japan national team. And U.S. Olympic gymnastics champion Simone Biles withdrew from team finals because of a medical issue due to a stumble during her vault. Nevertheless, the team went on to win a silver medal. After her stumble, 24-year-old Biles left the competition floor for medical examination, later returning with a wrapped right leg. She then rejoined her team to cheer on the U.S. team. Afterward, Biles congratulated the Russian Olympic team members who took the gold. Also in brief, on Monday, weightlifter Hidilyn Diaz made history winning the Philippines' first Olympic gold medal. The Philippines has been trying to earn a gold medal since they sent their first Olympians to compete in Paris in 1924. And Japan won gold in women's softball, upsetting the long-term U.S. softball champions 13 years after the Japanese beat the Americans at the 2008 Beijing Olympics. The Japanese team defeated Team USA 2-0 at Yokohama Baseball Stadium. Other than Japan's 2008 victory, the U.S. had won every softball gold medal since the sport's 1996 Olympic premiere. Wednesday's events will run the gamut and will include judo, boxing, and beach volleyball. And if you're wondering how the athletes are sustaining their drive to win, part of that must be food. As athletes cannot go out and about freely, most of that food will be from the cafeteria at the Athletes' Village. The featured Japanese cuisine is famed for its low-calorie healthfulness, and the village cafeteria is serving dishes from every Japanese region, but no raw fish due to food safety concerns. Organizers say there will be no pre-frozen foods, but halal, vegetarian, and even pizza and hamburgers are available, cold sodas too. The cafeteria is operating 24 hours a day with seating for about 3,000 and can dish out 45,000 meals a day. We'll have more from the Tokyo Summer Olympics tomorrow. Steve Ross for VOA News, Tokyo.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. With VOA Asia, also follow radio program hosts VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia. Cambodian authorities have stopped five large containers of water buffalo meat imported from India after determining the shipment was tainted with coronavirus, according to officials. All of the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. The first person charged under Hong Kong's national security law was found guilty Tuesday of terrorism and inciting secession in a landmark case with long-term implications for how the legislation reshapes that city's common law traditions. Reuters correspondent Gloria Tso reports.
The first person charged under Hong Kong's national security law was found guilty on Tuesday. 24-year-old Tong Ying Kit was found guilty of terrorism and inciting secession. In the landmark case, which has long-term implications for how the legislation reshapes the city's common law traditions. An alternative charge of dangerous driving causing grievous bodily harm was not considered. Tong, a former waiter, is accused of carrying a flag with the protest slogan, "Liberate Hong Kong, Revolution of Our Times," and driving his motorbike into officers during a protest last July, shortly after the security law was enacted. The charges could lead to a prison term of several years to life. His sentencing will be announced at a later date. His trial tests the limits of free speech in Hong Kong, as prosecution and defense argued over the meaning of the slogan, widely used during the city's mass anti-government protests in 2019. Pro-democracy activists and human rights groups see Tong's case as a departure from Hong Kong's common law traditions, since he was denied bail and a jury trial. The three judges at Tong's trial were picked by Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam to hear national security cases. Both Beijing and Hong Kong's governments have repeatedly said the security law was necessary to bring stability back to the city and assert that the rights and freedoms promised upon its return to Chinese rule in 1997 remain intact.
Gloria Tso reporting. Making headlines in Asia, Bhutan has inoculated most of its eligible population with second doses of COVID-19 vaccinations in a week, a speedy rollout hailed by UNICEF on Monday as a success story for international donations. More than 454,000 shots were administered over the past week in the remote Himalayan kingdom. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, Myanmar's state-run TV announced Tuesday that the country's election commission annulled the results of multi-party general elections held on November 8th due to misconduct of election rules and regulations in accordance with the Union Elections Law. To take a look at the broader implications of the decision, VOA's Steve Miller reached out to Greg Poling, Senior Fellow for Southeast Asia at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington.
I guess this is an unsurprising doubling down of the rhetoric by the junta, which isn't going to convince anybody. But clearly they're banking on this idea that they had first trotted out when they launched the coup back in February, that this was all because the National League for Democracy had somehow stolen the election. Nobody believed it then. And now that they're claiming they found 11 million cases of fraud in a country of 50 million people, of course, nobody's going to be convinced.
So what does this mean for democracy in the country? Because as you mentioned, you know, they were trying to make the case that there was fraud committed by the NLD. And back in May, you know, they dissolved the party. And, you know, going through the trial process right now is the de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, the president, Win Myint, and other leaders have been, you know, put up on charges. So what does this mean for democracy in a country that was already just experiencing a fledgling democracy?
It should be taken as further proof that the junta is not acting in good faith, not that I think anybody thought they were. Their initial claim after the coup was that they were only taking power for 1 year under provisions of the Constitution and withholding election. Since then, they've said, well, actually, maybe it'll be 2 years. Well, maybe it'll be whenever we get around to it. As you said, Aung San Suu Kyi is now on trial and likely to be imprisoned again on one of these five charges. And in all likelihood, they're going to disband and ban the National League for Democracy based on these trumped-up charges. So it's gone from bad to worse.
So if we take a look at the country itself, since that February 1st coup, there have been ongoing protests, deadly at times, that really haven't, you know, abated in earnest since the coup. Given what happened with the election committee annulling the results, what impact do you think it's going to have on the protest movement in general, as well as the international community who has repeatedly, you know, condemned the actions of the junta and their moves thus far?
I don't know that those engaging in the civil disobedience movement really care anymore what the junta authorities say. But it is going to be taken as further evidence that the regime has no interest in negotiating some kind of peaceful and equitable settlement here. They're really going for a scorched earth campaign against the NLD, against their international and domestic banks, the backers. And so it's only going to further this cycle toward state collapse, in which one side is basically an occupying power and the other side is trying to make the country ungovernable.
VOA Steve Miller talking with Greg Poling, Senior Fellow for Southeast Asia at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. We continue on VOA Asia. Fires continue to ravage the western states of the U.S. Dozens of fires have destroyed 500,000 hectares of forest. The situation is so severe that the smoke has reached the country's east coast. Angelina Bagdasarian has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
Around 80 large wildfires have ravaged some 13 U.S. states in the west. Hundreds of thousands of hectares of forest have been destroyed. The two worst-hit states are Oregon and California. Wild animals are trying to flee the fires, and local authorities say some residents have been forced to evacuate for their own safety.
That's the only house I've ever known. I was born and raised in that house, so it's like, don't want to lose it.
The most aggressive fires are ravaging on the border between Oregon and Northern California.
Fortunately, there's not a lot of people that live in those particular areas. And had those same fires occurred in the more populated parts of the country, it would have been complete and absolute devastation.
Over 20,000 rescuers are working on the ground, in the air, and even from specialized trains, trying to put out the deadly fires. Local authorities, though concerned about the situation, are promising to do all in their power to deal with the grave situation.
We have more than 2,000 personnel working on the bootleg fire alone. Our heroic firefighters, logistical experts, communications, and operations professionals. Federal resources have been called in, and teams from Utah and California are partnering with us in this fight.
Even though the area is not new to wildfires, this season is particularly bad, say experts.
The western United States, we're under just exceptional, terrible drought. And so the plant life there is just gasping for water, which makes it really, really easy to burn. And so we have high temperatures and we have very low relative humidities and plants that are very dry. And it's just setting itself up for the perfect storm of just some extreme, extreme fire behavior.
The smoke from the wildfires on the west coast has reached the eastern part of the country.
The smoke is traveling almost 5,000 kilometers, and it's impacting the eastern United States as far away as New York City.
The wildfire season that usually starts in California in the fall has shifted considerably, say scientists. But they add it's natural for the state to experience wildfires.
Fire is not this big evil monster that's up there to try to gobble up your children. It's actually a natural process in the ecosystems of the western United States. Traditionally had occurred every 5 years or so, very, very low intensity. But because we got really good at putting out fires, all this plant life grew up, and then you throw drought on it, and there's just not enough water to go around, and it's just setting itself up for just terrible, horrific conditions.
Scientists add that 90% of fires on the western coast are caused by people. For Angelina Bagdasarian in Los Angeles, Anna Rice, VOA News.
Even with the coronavirus pandemic easing in some parts of the United States, many people still prefer contactless delivery. One company is here to help with its delivery bot. Dina Mitchell reports from Austin, Texas.
Order a pizza in Austin, Texas, and it might be delivered by one of 10 three-wheeled robots. The company behind the robot says it's hoping to deliver more than pizza.
We just envision a future where this is a de facto standard for delivery.
Many companies are trying to solve the problem of last mile delivery, that last leg of the journey to get a product to a home or business. But one expert points out that delivery robots face obstacles.
People's houses have far more variety than a street. It's just exponentially more complex.
Customers must come out and enter a code to retrieve their order. But for now, the robots have help. An attendant follows on an electronic scooter to make sure all goes well, just until the robot's artificial intelligence learns the streets. The Rev 1 can go up to 24 kilometers per hour, carrying 7 grocery bags. It recognizes traffic signals and signs.
Dina Mitchell reporting for VOA News. You've been listening to VOA Asia. Like us on Facebook, VOA Asia. Follow us on Twitter at VOA Asia. You could find us on Instagram and YouTube and at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and our thanks to Service Chief Diane Gao. Our VOA team includes Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, Amy Hybels, Chris Cascale, and Jim Stevenson. I'm Ira Melman. Please stay safe and enjoy the day.